Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk.
TNT Radio.
TNT Radio. If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at tntradio.live. This is the Alan Miller Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome everyone in London and in the United Kingdom. Hello, East Coast, and good evening, Australia, and everyone around the world. It's great to have you back again today on the show. What a brilliant show we've got today. Just a few things from Britain that we should note this week that are really important. Firstly, a big hurrah, a big shout out to Cambridge, to all of the protesters and the campaigners that were challenging the congestion charge that have now enabled a new situation to happen for the council, Cambridgeshire County Council, to recognise this, to step back and not implement it at the moment. This has been a huge victory. Brilliant campaigners, particularly Cheyenne Roloffs, who's been on the show. And what I was so struck about when we got involved and sort of supported them was just the cross-section of people. People talk about diversity a lot, but the different type of demographic, people from conservatives to trade unionists and a range of people that were sort of not political in that kind of narrow sense. And just lots of people in the public saying, we don't want this, we don't need this, you need to listen to us. It's a great example of what happens when the public say, we don't want this, we want our voices heard, and they campaign and organise. And we don't just think that anything's inevitable, it's all just part of this thing or that thing, and that we assert our agency. And today we're going to be talking about asserting our agency, or the lack of it in some instances, and the sense of what the public's like. I'm very excited, and I'll introduce you to my next guest in just a moment. It's also to be noted that, of course, as you, Les, has been implemented, all sorts of things have happened. Bromley Council, maybe seen as a bit of tit for tat, said they're going to charge TfL vans if they park on the verge. But more substantially, we've seen that Noel Wilcox has had a number of charges overturned in the tribunal, saying that the signs demarcating them are not acceptable according to English law. Obviously, the answer to that might be, well, the mayor will just spend more of our money, as he has been doing on things. But it does beg the question, when so many people are challenging legally and campaigning and organising, why is this thing still continuing and can it get stopped? And we've seen in Warrington and in Southwark and many other places, things can get stopped and get changed. In fact, we've just seen Newcastle take out low traffic neighbourhoods, saying that their cars spill out into local residence areas, that it has not been of benefit. Did not make people walk and cycle, as though somehow that's got to be the great outcome. I love cycling and walking, but I wouldn't be able to do deliveries on a bicycle. And my mum can't get around on one either. And that's for society. It seems like some of the ideologues today have forgotten what society means. It seems like some in Labour have forgotten what the word Labour means. All the political parties need to take note of this and not just say it from the point of view if they want to get the votes. But the public needs to be front and centre. And I was very struck at a recent debate where I heard the next guest we've got on the show speaking all about criticism and about history and about people and judgment and discretion, and the way that the changing mores of how we consider people is impacting in so many of our areas in terms of museums and culture, in terms of education and society generally. And they're often the idea that we're just a bad lot, we're a toxic, polluting, nasty rabble, similar to the discussions around traffic, similar to the discussions that we saw around whether you were for Brexit or Remain, that many people are just pretty disgusting. And actually what's needed is limits and restrictions, and we can't really rely on judgment and discretion. And certainly the past is viewed in a way often like that too. So it was really good that I managed to get a moment for the very busy Dr. Tiffany Jenkins, who's a writer and broadcaster. She's also the author of Strangers and Intimates and Keeping Their Marbles, as well as currently writing her new book, which is Strangers and Intimates, The Rise and Fall of Private Life, which is going to be published shortly by Picador. Her last book, In Keeping the Marbles, How Treasures of the Past Ended Up in Museums and Why They Should Stay There, examined the influences at play in the growing prominence of the battle to return museum artifacts and the drive to repair historical wrongs. Tiffany's also an honorary fellow at the University of Edinburgh and host of the podcast Behind the Scenes at the Museum, in which she talks to key figures about the big ideas rocking the cultural world. She has written and presented several programmes for BBC Radio 4, including the series A Narrative History of Secrecy. She's also been an editor for Arts at the Battle of Ideas. And if you want to see her speaking, she will be on Saturday, the 28th of October, about what's happened to privacy. But I'm delighted to welcome you to the show today, Tiffany. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Alan.
So, I mean, just to kick off, really, your work has explored a number of things, partly what's happened in museums and the cultural sector. But I think a lot of it's about who we are and how we see ourselves. Would it be right to say that? And do you want to just give us a little insight into kind of your area of interest and how that came around?
Yeah, so if you look at the museum stuff, you can't go to a museum or gallery right now without being told off, being told you're somehow racist or sexist. So, for example, I went to the Rossetti exhibition at Tate Britain, and it's a beautiful exhibition, really lovely pre-Laffaite paintings and gorgeous frames. But these, along the side of them, there's all these lessons about how the Rossettis were basically white supremacists. And you just think that's a really odd thing. Why are you talking to me like this? This isn't really got anything to do with Rossetti. It's not historically accurate, particularly. I mean, the Cézanne exhibition recently also asked about colonization and all the rest of it. So there's this very strange sort of finger wagging going on directed at the audience who have paid £20 to go see this exhibition. You're not learning anything about the Rossettis. You're not learning anything about the Pre-Raphaelites, but you are being told off. And you're being told off a lot, I think, if you watch something like Bridgerton, even on Netflix. There's this sort of constant lesson that people in the past were bad, and you too are probably bad. And this is the kind of, you know, this is the public who want to go and see and learn about beautiful things and how things were in the past. So I think there's this sort of ingrained anti-humanism there. I'm just very normal people, not political people. You can see when they go to the museums and galleries now, they just sort of look at each other and shake their heads because they know they're being given the kind of the finger, if you like. So that, if I sort of try and tie that sort of museum and gallery stuff to my stuff on privacy, which might seem like a strange link and leap, but you yourself, I think, made the sort of connection. So the idea that we would have a private space where other people can't tell us what to do, basically, whether it's something like the police or the state, or even just be watched over by everybody else, that's not a natural phenomena. It's historically specific to really the 17th century. And it's obviously, as people will sort of see themselves, being eroded. The idea that we sort of should be surveilled the whole time and be watched. And I think one of the fundamental reasons for that is that they no longer, and they being either authorities or even sometimes each other, trust people to be on their own and not hurt themselves or hurt each other. So in both these cases, there is this sense that people need to be told what to think. People are fundamentally bad people, and also they can't be trusted to be on their own. So that might be a bit complicated, but I hope that answered that question.
Yeah, it did. I mean, let's drill down on it a bit further, because hasn't there always been a story of kinds? I mean, if you look at the Enlightenment, even the Renaissance, there's things that happen, and then there's a bit of a kind of narrative, an arc that's put together about those things. So from the Medicis onwards, you could say about mercantilism and trade, and you could see some of the changes that were happening. But there's a story that's connected. Part of it was Manifest Destiny in America. Part of it was this idea that, you know, there was like the idea of the white man's burden, mockingly, you know, with Kipling. There were all sorts of different ideas, but this idea of the Enlightenment and enlightened ideas. But at the same time, there was always more than a residue, a distaste for the mob. We know that even in the English and French revolutions and the American, that whilst you had the commoners, there were then these really smart people to make sure that the rabble didn't go too far. And wasn't there always a kind of, even in the days of the patricians with these beautiful museums where there was attempts to engage the public and educate, and like people think about the BBC with the Wreath, but inform, educate and entertain. Wasn't there always a contempt somewhat for the rabble? There was some fear of the mob, a sense that they just weren't trustworthy. And what's different to that? And am I overplaying it? And what we're seeing now with this sense of just general malaise about humanity generally?
I think in the past it was challenged more. And I think in the way the things that we're referring to, the sense of democracy and agency, were fought for and won temporarily. So the sense that, you know, one man, one vote, that was something that people had to fight for. The sense for women having a vote, the sense for equal rights in America. But those things were not granted because people suddenly thought everybody's equal and can be trusted. They had to be fought for, and they were won. There were lots of naysayers all along saying, no, people can't be trusted to do this. If you give them the vote, God knows what will happen. I think perhaps the people presenting the case for it were much more optimistic. And I think it's perhaps those voices that have also not fallen silent, but I would say there's a sort of a large liberal constituency who in their equivalents in the 19th century, people like John Stuart Mill, who argued for female suffrage, that liberal constituency that had a more positive and rounded version of what people could be capable of. They didn't think they were, you know, they still thought they needed to be educated and all the rest of it. But I think that sort of liberal constituency is the one who have fallen out of love with human beings. And I think probably the 20th century, which was a century of great gains, but it was also a century of violence and failure. The Russian Revolution, there's the sort of attempts to shape the world for the better, which did end in failure, I think have left people who would have once been on the side of democracy and the future, actually, they're the ones who sort of lost faith. You know, they used to have this sort of left-wing expression, which was don't mourn, organize. Don't mourn, organize. Which was a sort of realistic assessment of things, which is things are, you know, it's not all rosy in the garden, but we need to organize to make it better. And that, I think, has been flipped to we must organize to mourn, which is this sort of incredible sense of impossibility, really. And so with that kind of pessimism and failure and, yeah, sort of lack of utopian thinking has clouded everybody. And I think you can see it across the political spectrum.
It's a moment of thinking, oh, wow, that's terribly dark. But I think we shouldn't just skip over not just the terrible consequences of an experiment with the Russian Revolution and ending in the Gulag. Obviously, many people have written beautifully and terrifically and horrifyingly about it. But the shadow of the 20th century and also of fascism and the Holocaust and how that has come to epitomize man, particularly perhaps white man, but the man's potential for evil, not just potential, but almost like it's an innate, inherent thing, almost like the chimp paradox run amok, left with weapons. And that sense of experimentation, it's inevitable, right? If you let people, you have these terrible tyrants and people are just going to let it happen. And it becomes this self-justification for just allowing things to go. But it does seem to me, I don't know what you think, but before we go to the break, that there are new shoots emerging, sprouting, where people are sort of the appetite and the spirit for freedom. And forget the sort of what it was left or right or centre, because, but just that sense that humans should be able, we should be able to explore and develop and curate and create the kind of world that we want to live in, the kind of society that, or even if it's just to reassert previous things that had some of those freedoms entrenched, we don't want to get them taken away. But it does seem that some of that's bubbling all over the place. I don't know what you think about that.
I do. Yeah, it depends on what day I wake up and what I listen to in the news and talk. When, you know, when I talk to people, do I feel optimistic or pessimistic? I think it's both. I think I feel both, but I think there is undoubtedly a desire for something better. And I think people have sort of, from the 1990s up until about 2014, maybe 2008 with the Arab Spring. There's this incoherent desire for something better and to be almost in charge of it. And I think it's almost like it's pre-political. There are all sorts of flashpoints that you just can't predict. You, Liz, being one of them. I think some of the climate change stuff, the way in which it's, the way in which policy is imposing real limits rather than sort of coming up with creative solutions is having a very negative impact upon people. And they are beginning to say that is not right. And we can do better than this. And I think people do ultimately, even in younger generation, people are always sort of complaining about millennials or whatever the next generation is, but they want to live in a nice world. They want to feel, I mean, nobody likes to be told they're rubbish and racist and horrible and sexist. You know, lots of people do have a little bit more self-respect. So I think something is happening. I just don't know where it's going.
On that note, stay with us to find out maybe if we can explore where it's all going and what you could do about it too. I'm Alan Miller. I'm here with Dr. Tiffany Jenkins. This is TNT Radio. We'll see you just after this break.
Rick Munn on TNT Radio.
So disappointing, man. So many great actors, well, formerly great actors, musicians, comedians, you name it. The list goes on and on and on. What do they have on these people, Darren, that despite the fact that they're in the twilight of their careers, they're multi-millionaires, they're financially sound, they can do whatever they want, they still bow down and kiss the ring, as it were, and bow the knee to these wokists and these COVIDians. What the hell happened? What's happened to people?
I'm a firm believer that for the vast majority of these established acts, musicians, bands, the reason that they got to such lofty heights and fame and money and wealth that they did was because ultimately they sold their soul in order to get there, and for them to push the COVID narrative or the woke narrative or whatever it might be, that's something that's probably in the contract that they signed on the dotted line.
Rick Munn is locked and loaded on today's News Talk TNT Radio. A better business tip from TNT Radio. One reason people tune in to TNT Radio is often because they're loyal to a specific show or personality. Our personalities have been a part of people's daily routine, and people continue to tune in. They trust TNT Radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live. Alan Miller on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back. I'm Alan Miller. I'm talking to Dr. Tiffany Jenkins. Tiffany, just we've done a big broad span, but let's just to bring it back a little bit into kind of what's going on at museums and sort of like our view of ourselves. Because you said just before the break that people obviously don't want to hear that they're racist and sexist. I mean, some people may well be those things. I mean, but it, as a kind of general position on things. From how you see it, what's the role of an institution like museums and art galleries, and why are we failing if we are? How would that get resolved? What would be the, this is how we do it, in your view, if you were the lead curator of Britain?
If I was in charge,
yeah.
Yes. That would be nice. I tend to see them as a, this is museums in particular, I tend to see as a kind of time machine. You step out of your day-to-day world, you know, where your head is full of getting to work, doing shopping, taking care of the children, whatever it might be, and you go into a kind of a quieter space and you have an engagement with an object. And it might be a Ming vase, or it might be the Elgin marbles, or it could be a map, you know, a really old map, or just a very ordinary pot from the Middle Ages that people used to eat their what gruel. And it could be that they're just simply beautiful, and that is uplifting. And it sort of almost connects you to those people, so it crosses time and space. Or it could be informative. So one of my favorite exhibitions was the Assyrian exhibition at the British Museum, which is this sort of ancient, very violent empire that's really difficult to understand, because it's just, you know, thousands of years old and quite alien. But this exhibition was able to actually show me something about them, in particular the sort of their kind of colossal appetite for risk and violence. And it was fascinating. So I think it connects us to people. It helps us understand that the past is a very different place. And it's fundamentally educative. We do learn stuff about it, even if you're not going, you know, with your homework book and writing all your notes. You can't help but, I think, pick something up. I mean, they are incredibly popular. The British Museum is 6 to 7 million people a year, free to go. It's extreme, you know, there are lots of tourists, but also lots of locals. You know, you have to stand in the queue for the Natural History Museum to see all the dinosaurs, which is obviously more natural history than artifacts. So they're incredibly popular, but they are, despite that popularity and importance, they are in real trouble. And I think they have been for a number of decades. And that is that I think those that in charge of them, despite being, you know, a passionate people, they've allowed themselves to get defensive and insecure, and to have a kind of, to hand the reins over to activists who want to almost tear them down. And these activists are in the institution. There's a sort of self-hatred almost about it. So museums have often been called elitist, even though, you know, 7 million people are going to the British Museum. It's seen in it, and it's got lots of school kids and different cultures and classes and all the rest of it. They're seen as now, there's almost as if the sort of the past itself is toxic. You have to kind of quarantine it or tread really carefully. It's like it's a bomb that will go off if you're not too careful. So I think they are failing. And I think, but when I go around, like I went around the Burrell Collection in Glasgow, which is in this beautiful country park, and it's got this amazing collection of Chinese artifacts. And there's sort of some fairly androgynous Buddhists that are Buddhist artifacts, and it's got all trans stuff all over it. How these are trans people, which they're obviously not. No matter what your position on trans is, they're kind of these ancient sculptures of Buddhists. They're not trans, so it's this really strange kind of anti-history, anti-sort of, it doesn't tell you anything about the Chinese artifacts, it doesn't tell you anything about the meaning. But if you go around, the people, ordinary people who have come to this gallery to see something interesting are just really cross. And they're just normal people, they're really cross. And what we sort of, I think, need is to amplify those voices, because they just want to learn a little bit or to see something from the past that's interesting. That's all they want. Not too much to ask, but institutions are failing. And so we have to find a way of sort of amplifying those very ordinary everyday responses, which says, no, just tell me about the object. How old is it? Where's it from?
But the institutions are failing. You've said that there's activist people within it. I want to sort of understand a bit how it's happened. Because you had things like in the 60s, the long march through the institutions, people like Daniel Cohn-Bendit, this idea that maybe the left could not have won the political battle. They went on the cultural march. I'd like to explore that a bit more. When you say there's activists, so people understand, how do we get into this position, right, where people are in this place? But also, just to take one point you made about the Assyrians, and if you look at all empires, and you look at Genghis Khan, and you look at Alexander the Great, you look at the Ottomans, all very important epochal periods, obviously the Romans and the Persians. I mean, all of it has violence and power at the heart of it, as well as some other things, right? I mean, I don't want to be crass, that, you know, that has all sorts of intellectual, cultural moves forward, leads forward, but it's intertwined. Now, this idea, a sense of us as being inherently one thing or another, rather than it being much more complicated, but still retaining those things, it does seem that violence and destruction has also been part of beauty and creativity. And is that surely not just part of the whole thing? When we're looking at things, and how much is this new activist thing, and when you say about how you think it's come about, how much of that is just making it one-dimensional? But is it still some of the concerns they might have and issues still really be part of the picture we should be exploring? I just wonder how you see that.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. How did it happen? Well, if we just take museums, because I think similar things have happened in institutions at slightly different times and with slightly different influences. But museums, in the late 60s, I think suffered a crisis of authority. And that means, I think it's almost like they came to the end of the road at being confident about saying, this is our narrative, this is our version of the past. This is it, you know, what we know best, if you like. And the whole idea of having knowledge about the past, I think, became something that they were no longer confident about. So they started sort of looking at different theories about knowledge. There's multiple ways. It's just kind of a relativism. There's multiple ways you might approach, for example, the Assyrians, and maybe we don't know best. And maybe other cultures might know best, or maybe there are alternative sources. And that broke down quite quickly, I think, internally within the institution. So they started there was a tremendous amount of self-doubt, but they were able to motor along for a while, partly because they already had the objects, they already had the knowledge and all the rest of it. But then new generations did come, and they had internalized that a lot more deeply. And I think what you have then is, if you like, we have this sort of two types of person in an institution. One that has a sort of doubting, underconfident approach, but generally thinks the point of this institution is to understand artifacts, preserve them, care for them, and present them to the public. But maybe that's a bit difficult and hard, and I don't quite know how to do that. So you've got that type. And then you've got the younger generation who, and I'm talking now about sort of 80s and 90s, who think actually this is a place to do politics, right? What we need to do, all sorts of social problems, we need to solve them in this institution. So identity issues, sex issues, you know, feminist issues. That's what the museum's job is to do. And they're the passionate ones. In the 80s, you know, they're the ones with a vision, and they've got fire in their belly, and they have the confidence that the other type of curator just doesn't have. And you have this sort of dance, if you like, between these two constituencies. And at each stage, the activist curator wins. And at each stage, you know, you have this big battle over different artifacts. Should they go back? Should institutions be more responsive to certain identity groups? At each stage, they win. And it's really escalated now, where institutions, I think it's, you know, there's, I think after BLM, there was a sort of tipping point where institutions were just, you know, abasing themselves and whipping themselves for something that they actually had absolutely nothing to do with, but just constantly apologizing. And now you've got a sort of drive to return artifacts to different, particularly African countries, but there isn't necessarily anywhere for them to go. And it's likely, this is a slightly a convoluted way of showing the dynamic, but it's likely that they'll just end up in a private collection of the king in one instance, rather than they're not going to another museum, for example, which there might be a very strong case for. But the drive to kind of sponge institutions from artifacts is coming internally. And it can only sort of be changed, I think, by people standing up to the activist curators. And that means other curators need to grow a bit of backbone. We kind of need to kind of help them do that, I think.
Yeah, I wonder.
Does that answer your question?
It does. And also, I suppose the point, just, I mean, it's a much more difficult, big, we could have a whole day on just this and much more, but how much this idea of us as humanity and how much violence and conflict, but also beauty and within all of that, it's a bit off topic, but I'm wondering what you think about that, that the greats, in inverted commas, this is sometimes the accusation that's thrown, right? That, yeah, it's all great, all these greats, they've the great, but it involved lots of plunder and death and destruction. From it came some things, some great things, I mean, from wars generally, innovation, or how to kill our fellow people. That, I mean, like, and is that symbolic of humanity and a metaphor, or are we just too obsessed with the dark things and not enough of the light? And
well, I think you're right. I think if we went back and read some of the history, or went to some of the, you know, if you could go back in the time machine and go to some of the exhibitions from, say the 1940s or something, you would think it was incredibly rosy, like everything's happy in the garden, and this is, you know, this is inevitable march of progress. That's not the sort of thing I would be calling for. But I think something is odd about today, which is, despite although I mentioned that exhibition about the Assyrians, that's a one-off. And I think what's really odd is that when you go and see exhibitions or you read history about the past, and it's very negative, you don't seem to learn that much about it. Okay, so there's quite a lot of stuff being done on empire and slavery, the British Empire and slavery, some quite interesting stuff coming out. But it's been so moralized by that message, which is human beings are always bad and we need to face up to our past, which is the thing we're always told. It's been so moralized, actually, you don't really learn about the slave trade because the moral message is so blunt. And it obscures everything. So that's the strange thing. It's like, despite this obsession with the past and the worst aspects of it, we're not learning about the worst aspects of the past because it's just turned into this moral message. So I'm all for, you know, getting those skeletons out of the closet, right? Get them out of the closet. Let's find out, because it's not our history. You know, it's only tangentially our history. We didn't do it. Let's find out about it. But we're not doing that because it's so much of a moral message. That's the only thing that matters.
So Civilization was something that was a TV series that reflected on the history of many epochal moments and its contribution to humanity. When a new version was done, it was called Civilizations more recently. And I wonder, just in terms of that, to what extent you started off before talking about the achievements that we've made and how we've stepped away from them somewhat and embarrassed about them, and how much this discussion of the Western canon, which is also tied up with imperialism and other things. I mean, you know, it was the Industrial Revolution and the people that had the power and the money to make things and do things. And it wasn't generalized necessarily entirely across the planet. So how much, again, I suppose just before we go to the next break, this is that a difficult question as well. What would your thing be? Would it be a kind of, let's have a new, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but a renaissance, sort of like thinking, or what? How would it be? How do you see it? Would it be reclaim the idea of civilization and the victories for humanity? And does that include all sorts of other things that weren't necessarily in what they call the part of that discussion? I mean, things from Central Asia and Eastern Asia and all of that, like, you know, achievements you mentioned, bit of sculptures and all of that. You know, how do you see that? And should we aim for a kind of idea of civilization and humanity's role within it and how it reflects through our institutions and also how we see ourselves in education and doing things, really? Easy question, just before the break.
Well, I see the civilization in terms of the way you describe it as the best that has been thought and said and made. And that could come from anywhere. Let's have that conversation, because in fact it's kind of arguing over what should be included, that you have you make judgments and you work out what's the basis for your judgment. And it's a really, it's a small thing, but if you ever have a row about a piece of music you really like with somebody who really knows their stuff, or a TV program you've seen, it helps you understand the work better, right? You think, that's why I like it. That's why it works. That's why that's why Game of Thrones is better than this. Or that's why I've just watched The Last of Us and I thought it's really good. And you think, why is it so good? And you have to kind of talk about it. So yes, you row about what goes in the canon, you talk about it. And sometimes some things will be demoted and some things promoted. You're not going to go back. I'm not saying let's go back to the 19th century version of what we all had to read, because things have moved and what we're interested in changes. But the fact is, there are some things that are better than others, and I would like everybody to share in them. And being part of that kind of conversation means that we're not treating things with indifference. People have made things that are beautiful and interesting and tell us about ourselves. And that's part of the work of being human. And if we're not involved in that, then in a way we're kind of disrespecting the human.
We're going to come back and talk about all sorts of things. I want to talk a bit about the public-private points you were making, Tiffany, and how this plays out. But we've got all that to come. I'm here with Dr. Tiffany Jenkins. I'm Alan Miller. This is TNT Radio. Come back to us just after this break.
With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
Sometimes heroism develops over time. It takes incredible moral courage to admit that you were wrong. Famed cardiologist Dr. Anish Koka is one such hero. Dr. Koka, a cardiologist with degrees from Penn State University and Temple University Medical School, who's trained at Jefferson Health in Philadelphia, has expressed his regret at regurgitating the party line, as he put it, on mRNA vaccines being safe and effective for young people. He has vowed that he would never behave the same way in a similar situation again. Dr. Koka especially regrets his personal role in propagandizing for the vaccines, as he has put it. Me running around saying it's safe and effective, that was a mistake on my part. This is a very cardioactive vaccine. Kudos to Dr. Koka and those of his colleagues who have similarly stood up and told the truth about these death jabs. We need to praise such heroes and applaud their courage. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
I'm Smokey Bear, and I made an assistant to help you prevent wildfires.
Dude, I've got this. I've been camping since I was 5 years old.
But I am a camping influencer.
You know what? I'll bet you $5. Assistant Smokey, what is the best way to put out a campfire?
To put out a campfire, drown with water, stir, drown again. Then make sure the fire is out cold by feeling with the back of your hand.
Wait, really?
I'll take the $5.
Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
Alan Miller on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back. I just left after that very poignant overview from Tiffany, just thinking about the remarkable things that happen when you have like a piece of music that you might like, Bach, or you might have Shostakovich, Rachmaninoff. I'm a lover of the Russians often, but you know, or Beethoven, something like really complicated, like the Triple Concerto, which I remember myself, I kept hearing it differently, to your point, each time I listened to it. And after a while, some of the musicians said they dreamed about it at night, and I thought, oh yeah, what are they talking about? But I actually made a little documentary about it all, and then I was dreaming about it, and the music came to haunt me, and I heard it much more. And like Shakespeare, you see more within it as you learn it more and see it more. And that part of the education and the love for something, the passion of great work, great art, and also history and our relationship to it. I really like the way you talk about that and the thing why it's so important and important to discuss and not just devalue. But you said something about the public and the private. And I guess that this is because obviously public institutions are very public, and whether you fund them through taxation or through private, you know, like they do in the States a bit more. But this relationship to the public and the private, I mean, Hannah Arendt, once said, I think, that if you don't have a strong private arena where you can have your own freedom and privacy to do what you want uninhibited and, you know, not unsurveyed, very important, then you don't have a strong public sphere, because you can't actually be in the public without being able to retreat and withdraw into the private sphere. I wonder what you think about that, if you would talk a bit more about that. And the other thing that you'd said, I want to get this in before we finish the show, is this thing about we know best. Because, you know, the thing is, we know best used to be an idea, and like there would be pedagogues, there would be people who are really brilliant, they're experts. But we've just heard over the last 3 years, we know best. Follow the science, whatever that means, the science. These are the experts. It's almost like outsourcing to the experts. People did say we know best. They said, stay indoors, hands on heads, we know best. Then it became apparent it wasn't quite that way. I mean, it was apparent to some people up front that it could never be quite like that, right? So, because there's often, you have to make decisions about things, not just what, even if something looks like something, then you have to decide what you're going to do about it. So, they're the two things I'd like to look at with you now. I mean, just firstly, the public-private thing and how much you think, from what you can see, both in the world that you work in and look at, but also in terms of the political realm, how much of an issue you see this as being. I mean, people, citizens being allowed to be able to think and do what they want in their own space, and also their relationship to the public. Where's the citizen gone in the public, really?
No, I think it's really, I think the kind of the public-private thing is the most important thing. I mean, not just because I've just written a book on about it, but I think you can see it as impacting on everything we're doing. So to make it less abstract, obviously during COVID, we had no private life, in as much as everything we did in our lives was dictated to, right? We had to stay at home. You could only go out for wherever you were in the world, you could only go out for X amount. I mean, you had the authorities telling you what you could and couldn't do. And in a way, what you had was a sort of decommissioning of public life. Everything in your, I mean, in Britain, you had, you know, people couldn't meet up to have sex. I mean, obviously they did, thank the Lord, because people are still people. But it's a remarkable amount of control over people's private lives. And we had no public life. So Parliament shut down. There was no way of, you know, voicing dissent, really difficult. When people did take to the streets, they're obviously demonized. So they were kind of prevented also from being sick people. And I mean, I thought it was a terrible thing as a to do to people, because it meant that they had no agency in their own lives. And we then just communicated, you know, people were just communicating with each other through screens, and you had everybody's messy bedrooms out, and that's a very little distinction between public and private. I think the thing is that if you're always thinking about whether somebody is watching you or can tell you what you can do, which is what you have when you have no privacy and when all parts of your life are surveilled or controlled, you never quite turn off. And it's almost like you probably become slightly paranoid, but you never make them, you know, it's very difficult to make mistakes, to walk around in your underwear, just to have a row with somebody, with your partner, with your lover or whatever, and for that not to be kind of blown out of all proportion. So it's like, I always look at it as a sort of, it's like private life is a sort of, it's your garden. And I mean, you know, you're in the ground or whatever, and you need that darkness. And then if you have it, then you can grow. You can subject yourself to the light, and you absolutely need both. But during COVID, and even post COVID, you have that sense that people really need to be controlled and to be watched. And the way I see it is that it's entirely likely that we're bad in private. We're not our best selves. We rant, we rave, we say stupid things, we don't dress properly, we, you know, rush our dinner, all that stuff. We're not our best selves, but we need that to be able to be our best selves and to be kind of strong public people. And maybe we make mistakes, but you know, that's all right. We make mistakes. People have to be free to make mistakes. We can't all be exactly the same, identical good people. That would be a nightmare.
Yeah, and then this question, well, that's very well put. I like that, the light and the darkness in the garden. That's very well put. And I'm just very excited to read your book. So everyone should get that. Well, let's give it a plug at the end again and how people can find out more about you. But this question about the experts, we know best. what's the relationship between people that really do know an enormous amount about their area and speciality, we know best in that arena and that sense of authority, and what we've just seen in the last 3 years? I mean, you know, you just talked about constant surveillance, all the things being shut down, but we were told we know best. Be quiet. You're dangerous. Asking questions is going to cost lives. We know best. These are the experts. Are you an epidemiologist? Are you a virologist? I mean, how many times did anyone hear that? How far does the we know best thing, tell us where that should apply in your view and where it should be contested. There's the kind of political arena versus maybe the kind of how we reflect things. And I don't know, but I'm interested to hear what you think about that.
Well, science, this is sort of relevant for climate change. So science can tell us many things. It can talk about causality, you know, it can identify causes, it can speculate on what will happen, it can think about the ramifications, and it can tell us what's going on, but it can't tell us what to do, because that's political. Partly because there will be different, you know, there are different things that could be done about climate change. And scientists aren't going to shouldn't have the final say over that. That's when you have to have politicians coming up with ideas consultations, the wrong word, come up with ideas, put them to the public and see and win them really. And I think you didn't get that here. So you didn't have that in COVID. So you had politicians hiding behind scientists, some of whom were more than, you know, when you're told you're great and you have the answer to everything, sometimes you think, yeah, I do. And maybe it's maybe a few of them did that way too much, and those that dissented, you know, were silenced or crushed or pushed aside. So that was not an ideal way of behaving at all. Most things, if they try and silence you, there's a sign that they don't quite have the power of argument, and it would have been much better had they won people properly to what they wanted to do, because now nobody, you know, it's all, everybody wants to forget because they know it wasn't quite right. It's much better to get people to do what you want them to do without making them, which is what effectively they did. So more public discussion, basically.
So
on climate change, on regulations around COVID or whatever it might be, more public discussion, light scrutiny, that sort of thing is essential.
Absolutely. Well, it was just remarkable that the Department for Culture, Media and Sport actually sponsored spy units on journalists and others, as well as the government's rapid response team doing that. You'd think the Department of Culture, Media and Sport's role should be to do something that, you know, to do sport and all the things we've been talking about, culture and art. And yet there it was, just doing that. I think the thing is that you talked about is so essential. Certainly at Together, it's been our sort of central focus, which is the role of the public and winning hearts and minds and engaging people. So a lot of the things we've seen both in during COVID, actually beforehand as well, where I saw it in nightlife, people saw it in different places, people like the Manifesto Club, Josie Appleton, many reflected the public are seen as this contamination, as an antisocial behavior, as a limiting activity on the streets, whether it's taking a remote controlled car to a park or giving out flyers on the street, this sense of limits and restrictions, stopping busking, stopping any kind of spontaneity, the frisson of a city, which was always the thing that was remarkable, this sense of freedom and that you could have with possibilities. And those long march through the institutions, those activists who have now become fearful. Let's say, I think often people who say they're in Labour, who have lost their relationship with Labour, but, you know, the Conservatives often had a view about this as well. But generally, that people are untrammeled will be very dangerous. They'll do terrible things. They're not trustworthy. They need to be restricted. So we've had these two or three decades, really, of bureaucrats and technocratic control that has led to things like, even when Liz Truss wanted to do something, she never won the public over. She didn't really win her peers over. And in a similar way, everything from Sadiq Khan not really going out, he's said what he was going to do a lot, but he's not won hearts and minds. He hasn't, you know, he's ignored the consultation. We've seen it around the country, low traffic neighborhoods, there isn't a discussion. They call them consultations. They often don't send them to people, and then they ignore the ones that come back. And so that sense of a strong public and a burgeoning spirit of we you talked at the start about civil liberties and the women's vote and you know, in the 60s and everything. In many ways, that's what, you know, together we think people should do more of. People often think, though, I think I'm interested in this point, that actually they share some of the elite's contempt to the public. They think people are a bit stupid. They might be asleep. They're all sheep. They're done. If only they could see what I could see. That sense that we've got to go and win hearts and minds, all of us. We've got to convince people. We've got to argue. We've got to try and have a better story. How much of that do you think is important? How confident and hopeful are you about it? And any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've all been there, haven't we? On a march or something, or even just talking to our friends. God, I mean, I remember that over Brexit. And I'd be saying, we just need to trust the people. And everybody around me would say, but you're wrong. You think, what? You don't always, people are, God, they're brilliant. But, you know, we do stupid things. We make the wrong decisions. We're a bit slow at times. But all of that said, it's still the best way of getting anything done. You know, there's that old phrase, isn't it, about democracy. It's a terrible system, but it's much better than anything else. I think on a good day, though, having those discussions with people, having whatever discussion it might be with anyone, makes you a better arguer, and it helps you clarify yourself, what you think. And you always know if you haven't quite worked it out yourself, not because they're not agreeing with you, but because you haven't quite been able to articulate the argument. So it's much better for you to have these conversations out in the open, and it's much better for everybody else, because it means that when you've won them, you've really won them. And what I've found over both COVID and ULEZ and many things at the moment, actually, is that it's not obvious what people are going to say and think. You know, it used to be at different times, you knew what side everybody was on. So although we've got this strange climate at the moment where, you know, dissent is clamped down upon, people are afraid to speak their minds, it's also there's an element of opportunity, because things aren't falling on strict political lines. People are beginning to think something's not quite right. I want something else. So in a strange kind of way, I've noticed in the last few years, really odd alliances. You know, you find yourself agreeing with people you never thought you would agree with. And I think that's quite exciting. I think that's quite an exciting thing. I think we're at the start of something new politically. We're not quite there yet, but I think it's happening. And so the more conversation, the more argument, the better, particularly now when you have seen authorities trying to clamp down on it. That's what all these discussions are about, which is basically saying, go back to sleep. So I'd rather be on the front line with somebody with whom I think's a moron, or a sheeple, arguing in public against whatever it might be imposed from above, because that you've got to have those arguments, and you never know, you might change their mind in the end, or they might change yours.
Yes, absolutely. Well, that spirit of engaging and trusting one another to be able to do it, and being open-minded enough to hear other things, but also reflect on them and still have the courage of your own commitments of ideas you've worked out. A lot more of that, I think, is required. We could talk about so much more, Tiffany, about what's happened in education, about what's happening more broadly politically. But just quickly, if you tell us about your book, when is it due? Sounds so instrumental, but what was the reason of doing it? And then just how people can find out about it and how they can see you. Just tell us a couple of your social media things, and that would be great.
Okay. Well, you can get my book on the museums, Keeping Their Marbles, How Museums Acquire Their Artifacts and Why They Should Keep Them, on Amazon. It's a brilliant read. My next book, which is Strangers and Intimates, The Rise and Fall of Private Life, is in my editor's hands as a manuscript. So we're a little way off a kind of physical copy of the book, but that'll be out at the end of next year. It takes such a long time, but it's worth it, because then you've got this kind of what I've tried to do is a long view of privacy. So there's a lot of discussions about privacy at the moment, but it's primarily around the internet and surveillance. And I wanted to say, well, where did it come from? Where did privacy come from and why is it important? So I actually go back to the 17th century. And it's all very, there's some really good kind of stories there about how people kind of fought for it. Again, it wasn't something the authorities wanted to give you. They had to fight for it and make the case that human beings should be trusted to be on their own and back off, basically. You can find out more about me generally on Twitter at Tiffany Jenkins, and that links to my Substack and all the other things. So go there first and there'll be a little trail of breadcrumbs.
Fantastic. Privacy, utterly essential. The online safety bill is one example of where some of these things in the public sphere, but also what we do generally, is under attack. The more that we can uphold our privacy and also defend our rights publicly, the better. I'm thanking you, Tiffany, for joining us today. I'm very excited about your new book. If you want to see Tiffany speak publicly, she'll be at the Battle of Ideas on the 28th of October. And you can obviously see more of this at Alan Vibe, at The Thread. And we will be back after the news. Thank you, Tiffany. Stay free. Keep questioning. Keep being critical, both publicly, and enjoy your privacy. We'll speak to you soon.